Welcome to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
Kahoot is underfunded, and if we think about unloading some of the workload of the police on Kahoot, we need Kahoot to have the same.
One of our fundamental underlying problems is the extreme economic inequality that has been developing in this country for the last few decades. And that's beyond the capacity of local government and even of state government probably to change.
And if all you have time to do is to just drive from one call to another, it really does a disservice not only to the relationship, but a disservice to the victims we're trying to serve.
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, Lane County, and the City of Eugene. And here is today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's July 31st, 2020 program. This is the second part of our series looking at accountability, transparency, and reform in local law enforcement. The name of the program is Alternatives to Policing, Reorienting the Scope of Law Enforcement. This is our 41st program and the final program for the 29-20 season. My name's Kitty Piercy, and I am the City Club President-elect. Our program is coordinated by Josh Purvis, and thank you, Josh, and I'm going to turn it over to you.
This two-part City Club program series will examine local law enforcement through the lens of recent events. Today's program, Alternatives to Policing, Reorienting the Scope of Law Enforcement, will pick up where last program left off. Eugene Police Chief Chris Skinner, local NAACP President Ibrahim Koulibaly, and Kahoot's co-founder David Zeiss will discuss the scope of local law enforcement and how it's responded to trends in local poverty and public safety, including homelessness, substance abuse, and mental illness. This timely and urgent conversation will survey Eugene's history of law enforcement in light of the larger issues around police accountability and reform. At the heart of these programs is the question, how can we cultivate and enforce greater equity, justice, and public safety in our community in light of where we've been and what direction we want to head? Today's motion for the conversation is our community contributing sufficient funding and support for the types of people and programs who can adequately provide alternatives to policing. So we'll begin the conversation with a series of opening remarks and transition to an intra-panel discussion. So Ibrahim, coming to you first, your response to the motion.
Thank you, Josh. Good morning, everyone. I would like to thank the City Club for facilitating this discussion. The City of Eugene has around 20% of the population under poverty line, which means that a lot of people in this city are struggling. And you know that we have coming next year, the payroll tax that will go toward public safety. And people are already giving what they can. And I think the question to me is the city using the funding provided by the community in the right direction? Because we have a lot of need. We have a crisis in homelessness. We have mental health issues. We have access to some type of mental health provider like psychiatrists, psychologists in the county here. We have an employment problem for some people with little a criminal record. You know, and the NACP has been conducting the expungement clinic for those people to be back job market. So you have a lot of need, and people are stretched when it's come to their income, because that's pretty much what people have to use to help the city to fund those programs. But looking at all of that and what people are already giving, if you turn to the business community will use whatever tax you, the taxes are being forwarded to the consumers. It's not something that they will take a hit without passing it on to us as a primary customer for those businesses. So I think we have to think in general about how we are using the resources we have, instead of thinking as a problem of not having enough resources, because that will always be a problem.
Thank you, Ibrahim. David, come to you. Your opening remarks to the motion.
Thank you, Josh and City Club, for inviting Whitebird to join in this conversation. When I first saw the motion, my initial answer was, well, no, absolutely not. We're not putting enough money into what we need to be putting money into. But then I noticed that I was sort of out of touch. For 25 years, I read every write-up of every intervention that CAHOOTS did. And I've been retired for 6 years, almost 6 years, still on the board of directors, but not having that kind of hands-on contact. So my first response was to contact some of the present-day Whitebird administrators and see what their impressions were. And turns out nothing has changed. So I have some places where it would be good to have more money put into dealing with alternatives to policing, taking a load off of police. This is not necessarily in any order of priority. The one that's closest to me is CAHOOTS. CAHOOTS staff are underpaid, and we're starting to notice some serious problems with recruiting and retention because of our salary level. We do need a substantial increase in support for CAHOOTS. That sounds self-serving, and maybe it is, but I've got a list of other things which probably are bigger issues and probably go beyond what we can take care of at the local level. One is the problem of homelessness. The only thing that will solve the problem of homelessness is housing, and housing is expensive, but we desperately need more low-income housing. We need more services for alcohol and drug issues, especially we need a social distancing COVID-19 compliant sobering and detox facility of greater capacity than we have had in the past, even when we didn't have social distancing requirements. And third, we need more access to mental health services, probably including additional hospital beds. And that's a statewide problem. The legislature really needs to give us more hospital capacity.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Josh.
And Chief Skinner, coming to you next for your opening remarks.
Thanks, Josh, and thanks to City Club. And I appreciate both Ibrahim's and David's comments on this. I would just simply say that there have been so many areas that have been underfunded or defunded over the years. The question of whether this community should be spending more on other things is an interesting one, in the sense that I'm not sure this community, it's their responsibility to fund certain things. When you think about mental health, that's not a City of Eugene function. That's a Lane County mental health function. And so when we think about where we should be looking at where funding should happen, and quite frankly, state and federal funding has gone down over the years. And so you think about mental health being defunded all these years, addiction services being defunded all these years, and quite frankly, whether people have dug into the details or not, the state of Oregon is the least police state in the United States per capita. And when you think about not adding any FTE to your police force for over a decade, you could make an argument that we've at least been somewhat defunded ourselves. And so when you have all three of these systems being defunded, then things tend to fall to the police department to deal with. And that's just not the direction we need to go. I need police officers getting back to what police officers should do. And I would 100% agree with David. One of the threats to our CAHOOTS model and our successful relationship we have is the massive turnover that they have, because they can't pay their people to stay around. And when we think about all of the dialogue about how CAHOOTS can come alongside and match a resource with a need, the question I often have is, do they have the capacity to grow to the extent that we need them to grow? And right now, I think just like most organizations that struggle with recruitment and retention, it's hard. It's hard for us to recruit and retain people, let alone an organization like Kahoot. So, you know, when we think about funding and we think about those things, I think we have to be mindful of where, whose responsibility is it to fund certain systems? And then of those systems, which ones should we put in place that are going to answer the needs that we have in our community?
Thank you, Chief Skinner. That's a lot to unpack there. So I want to come back to Ibrahim. Your response to what you heard Chief Skinner and David mention in their opening remarks, Ibrahim?
Well, I do agree with David that Kahoot is underfunded. And if we think about unloading some of the workload of the police on Kahoot, we need Kahoot to have the same pay and benefit. And I talk about that multiple times. We can, to me, when we talk about defunding the police, I think more about reallocating some of the resources that the police have to provide service like what Kahoot is doing. And I think the pay and the benefit for those workers are not enough, and they have to be. In my conversation, we even talked about if need be, that Kahoot and the police department being under the same umbrella, just one providing this type of service, and the police continuing to provide the regular police duties, because we need that type of investment. That's how Kahoot is important. And I agree with Chris Chief Skinner when we talk about, he talked about Oregon being one of the least police state. But at this point, we have to rethink the community policy in general, regardless of if we have more police officers or not. And the discussion should go around how to unload, like David said, how to unload some of the detach some of the services, some of the duties from the regular police department, and also address the need for the type of weaponry. I think that's what also bringing all those conversations, the equipment the police is using, but also the lack of services for mental health, for all the other low-income housing. So having that discussion, including the police, as we have done for the payroll tax coming, linking funding police to some of those services, will probably lead us to the right direction when it's come to change the way we do the we at least see community policy here. And part of that is the police department also have to we can start the conversation around the need to have a special department of force that may be used for violent crime, because we have, I believe, less than 10% of violent crime, police interaction for violent crime. Chris will probably correct me on that one if I'm wrong. And I think using all the, at least what we perceive to be a lot of money in equipment, like, you know, those cars and all the guns and all the protective gears, for the police department, it provides them with tools that they may be inclined to use, because you always use the tool you have. Kahoot is probably successful in de-escalation because they don't have weapon on them when they go on scene. So the de-escalation is the tools they have. So those kind of things may probably allow the community to save a little bit on what we're putting on the police department. But we do need a police department with the right amount of force to go after those who commit violent crimes.
Thank you. And David, coming to you, I've heard Chief Skinner talk about just the lack of funding for mental health and substance abuse treatment, largely at the county and the state level. And I've heard Ibrahim mention really the police using the tools it has available, which largely are around, you know, law enforcement, around use of instruments of violence, let's say. And so what's your response, David, to what you've heard from Ibrahim and Chief Skinner?
One important thing is that the police often don't use instruments of violence. The police often are very competent social workers, and that may not be the job that officers signed up for, but it's a job that they do most of the time fairly well. To take some of that load off of them, we do need more resources for other approaches. And it's quite true that some of this is most of it is county issues rather than city issues. And it will require some state support and probably some federal support, because one of our fundamental underlying problems is the extreme economic inequality that has been developing in this country for the last few decades. And that's beyond the capacity of local government and even of state government probably to change. Creating more resources for permanent stable housing for low-income people is also probably beyond the resources of city and county government. In the meantime, we do need places for people to camp if we can't give them housing, safe and legal places for people to camp and shelter under pandemic conditions. And we have some of that, but we need a lot more.
Thank you, David. And Chief Skinner, I want to come to you. What I'm hearing is there's a lot that's kind of out of your hands or out of your control, even out of the city's hands in terms of funding and support, addressing any number of societal problems. So how do you respond to what David and Ibrahim have identified as sort of these kind of inputs into our community that create, you know, concerns around public safety? How do you as police chief respond to that?
Well, I think it's important to note that as you hear the three of us talk, it would be interesting if you're picking up on the same thing I am, is that we're more in agreement than we're not around kind of the direction we're going. I think that's an encouraging sign, given all of our different swim lanes that we're in. You know, police have been the grease trap of everything that society can't handle for a lot of years now. Everything has fallen to us. And it's not lost on me that when we deal with somebody that's in crisis that finally needs a police response, ask yourself the question, how many systems have failed that individual prior to police arrival? And so when you think about funding some systems to make sure that they don't get to that crisis, that's kind of the premise, I think, of what we're talking about, of what we're trying to accomplish here. This police department, I know we're looking at a national narrative right now and kind of a national movement on police reform, but I'm trying to be really, really clear that, you know, we want to build something that's unique to Eugene, that fits Eugene, that this community can embrace and really call their own. And that's what I'm trying to accomplish here with key stakeholders. And we'll get started on that very soon, hopefully, and be able to do that. You know, David's right. I mean, you think about the thousands of encounters that we have every month of people. There's some level of social work in all of those encounters, whether it's stopping Mrs. Smith on a traffic stop or dealing with somebody that's in crisis and, you know, out in West Eugene and downtown or anywhere for that matter, is that those men and women have been trained to the extent that they feel like they can handle most things. We're not perfect, that's for sure. And, you know, part of the discussion around the way police look and the tools that they use is a difficult one for me, because so many of the tools that you see us use have been predicated by something that's happened in society that has forced us to kind of evolve that direction. Prior to 1999, after all those kids were killed at Columbine, we would have never thought that rifles were going to be a part of our vernacular. And then there's something happens that says we need a tool to solve this problem. The tremendous outcry for tactics or options other than your firearm to solve problems is where the taser and OC spray have come from. And it's hard to quantify how many deaths have been avoided by the use of less lethal technology. So I'm not opposed to taking a look at different ways of solving problems. I think it's important to note, though, that what we're expected to do is to try and solve problems at the lowest level of force necessarily. And there wasn't too awfully long ago in my lifetime, this is my 30th year of doing policing, that I didn't have those tools at my exposure. When I was a young cop out on the road, getting in fights out in the middle of rural Benton County, just north of here, I didn't have all those tools available. So the right tools are important, but more importantly than that, I think the right people in the uniform is important, because creative and thoughtful problem solvers have a tendency to find ways to solve problems that don't end in violence or end in the lowest and most reasonable response to people's resistance and use of force. And so we're really focused on making sure we have the right human beings wearing this uniform, especially here in Eugene.
Thank you, Chief Skinner. And so that concludes our opening part of the program. We've heard thus far from Ibrahim Koulibaly of Eugene Springfield NAACP, David Zeiss of CAHOOTS, and Chief Skinner of the Eugene Police Department.
You're listening to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene. Now, back to the program.
We'll now carry forward with a Q&A portion of our program. And Chief Skinner, I want to come to you first with the question. And that is, currently, Oregon has the third highest rate of addiction in the United States. I'll restate that. Oregon has the third highest rate of addiction in the United States, and is one of the least effective states in addressing issues related to mental health and substance abuse. What impact will budget cuts for next fiscal year, which will likely pull away resources from mental health and addiction recovery services, have on future crime rates in our community?
Well, I think, certainly when we look at our crime in our community and just looking at statistics over the last year, certainly 2020 is not in. I was looking at the violent crime rates, which is our traditional uniform crime reporting that we do to the FBI, is up about, overall is about 12% up in 19, was up in 19 compared to 18. And these are our violent crimes, or the more serious crimes that police respond to. When we think about crime, and especially what really, really plagues Eugene, which is those societal crimes, those lower level crimes, the thefts from your car, the thefts from your garage, the low level burglaries, the trespass, those types of things, the shoplifts that we see. So many of those crimes, as we investigate them, we're finding that there is a substance abuse nexus, or there's people that are perpetrating crimes and committing crimes that are they're crimes of survival, oftentimes based on being addicted to some type of controlled substance. That's not unusual for drug addiction and crime rates to follow similar trends. And so that's what's important. And you think about, our homeless population and the amount of mental illness and substance addiction or both going on there. It's really, really tough to stabilize people when they're in the throes of addiction. And we see that happen all the time. We get complaints of needles being found in and around parks, in and around camping sites, those types of things. And so we know that that's in play. We know that oftentimes there's a correlation between substance addiction and crime. And so when we think about trying to build a system that is crime-free, or we start to reduce crime, that's certainly a part of it. The other piece of this for me, and it's completely off the radar screen in this conversation, but the other piece of this for me is how do we raise a generation of crime-free kids? How do we start moving up and out of this downward trend of criminal behavior? And some of that is in our school systems and keeping kids in schools and making good decisions at a young age. And so there's a lot to build in a community that's headed, on a path of wellness around criminal behavior. It's not just about mental illness. It's not just about substance addiction. There's a lot of things in play here. It's getting people stabilized. It's getting people housed. It's getting people and kids staying in school. I mean, it's all of those things are interconnected when you think about trying to build a community that can be really, really proud of its crime rate or its trend around criminal behavior.
Muted. Ibrahim, coming to you, really kind of taking in this idea that, how often we use law enforcement to address these sort of outstanding or almost intractable social problems. I want to put it another way and put the question to you. Do you think that, in effect, there are two distinct criminal justice systems in Eugene, one for people of means and another for poor people and minorities?
Yes, thank you for this question. You have roughly 1.6% of Black people in Eugene, but 5.7% of the staff are Black people. So you kind of see that there is a disproportion right there. Also, looking at the economic disparities, consequences in Eugene here, talking about homelessness and even mental illness, because of not having access to health insurance and not being able to access those services. You have a lot of people. I know since Skinner became the chief of our police department, we had that conversation about what is it means to enforce some laws when you don't have alternative for them, like someone sleeping on the street and have nowhere else to go. There's no shelter available. And I know the Eugene police was working on that. And it all comes down also to the laws that our community want our police to enforce. Because the police is not creating the laws they are supposed to enforce. It's us, it's the community, it's the city. That would come up with some laws like, camping or that create all of those contact with either the minorities or the people who are poor, like as you said, poor people. So yes, as a person of color in Eugene, I feel less fortunate when I have contact with police. People have reported to NACP multiple times. They very stressful, traumatic interaction with Eugene police over things that, other people, even within the NAACP, because we have a lot of white volunteers, will say that, my experience has been different. So we have a record of that. We have a record and we just got our legal readers committee up and running with 6 lawyers. So we will be working on those issues specifically with the Eugene and Springfield Police Department to address this NACP, try to have a direct conversation with people to see how we can address those issues. Yes, we have the feeling that, me saying we, the Black community, have experienced a lot of negative contact with Eugene Police Department. We have received a lot of call from people who happen to be white but poor and having either adopted Black kids or having biracial grandkids, have those kind of same feeling. And we have experience as a resident of Eugene how most of the time there is a lot of interaction between the police department itself and people who are experiencing homelessness because they cannot afford to go anywhere else, and the business community is pushing the city, and the city is also requesting the Eugene Police Department try to remove those people from the safest area they find to be a safe spot for them to sleep.
Got it. David, coming to you next, I want to kind of piggyback on what I heard Ibrahim share. And one of the things that really stood out to me, what he said was, the idea of law enforcement is there to enforce the laws, but it's not they don't create the laws they enforce. That's the legislature that does that. And so, you know, this idea that our police in effect reflect sort of the values of the laws of our community, my question to you is, do you think that our community over-relies on law enforcement to address seemingly intractable social problems like homelessness, mental illness, and substance abuse?
That's an excellent question. But first, I want to say how much I agree with what Ibrahim has just said about the problem of the Black community in our country experiencing unequal enforcement of the law and unequal attitudes that go beyond police and are really pervasive, and I'm sure exist also in myself and in Cahoots and Whitebird. And we all need to be making that kind of personal and social change a priority. And that is an overriding umbrella issue that we all need to be paying attention to all the time. And then getting to Joshua's question, yes, when we don't solve social problems, they do become police problems. We ask the police to do something about them, and we are giving them an impossible problem. You can't law enforce people out of homelessness. The only thing that gets people out of homelessness is housing. You can't law enforcement people out of mental illness. The only thing that helps mental illness is mental health treatment. Enforcement also doesn't end addiction. We need resources for addiction treatment. And more fundamentally, to build a society with less of those social pathologies, poverty, homelessness, addiction, and to some extent mental illness, we need to look at our structural inequalities. We need to have people, we need to create a society that provides people with routes to self-respect, with employment that provides them an adequate income to raise their families at some level of comfort or at least security. And we are increasingly unable to do that. And that is really a deep problem. And it probably goes beyond anything we can accomplish purely local resources, but it really is where we have to look.
You know, Chief Skinner, coming to you, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, clearly come through is sort of all these macro inputs into our micro or local community. And so I want to bring it back down, you know, to the ground in our community. You know, I believe it was on July 20th, you gave a presentation to the Eugene City Council, and you highlighted a 12% increase in the number of criminal charges from 2018 to 2019, particularly burglary, larceny, and motor vehicle theft. What factors do you attribute to this increase?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Josh. So just to be clear, those aren't criminal charges. Because criminal charges happen at the district attorney's office after a really good investigation. Those are actually crimes that are occurring in our city. That doesn't mean we've solved those crimes. It doesn't mean we made an arrest in those crimes. But it just means that we took a call and we were able to substantiate that somebody was a victim of that particular crime. And that's really what our approach is we look at this from a criminal perspective, but the Eugene Police Department and I for years have looked at this from a victim-centered approach. Every one of these crimes is a victim, and that's who we're supposed to be serving, is the victims of a crime. When we look at criminal behavior and criminal activity, it's really, they're in a couple of different buckets, some of which can be deterred and prevented. And others, unfortunately, can't in many cases, at least by local law enforcement. And so there's a couple of different strategies depending on what you're trying to accomplish. For those crimes that are really hard to deter and interdict before they happen, you're hoping your police department has adequate resources to respond, to connect with victims, to be able to do a really good investigation, and then put the resource to the investigation to identify who's committing the crime. It's not uncommon to have, you know, 80 or 90% of your crime being committed by 5 or 10% of the people in your community. It's not, it's a very small percentage of people that are committing these crimes. For instance, burglary and car prowl are crimes that are committed over and over and over again, often by the same groups of people. And so if you can really investigate and do a good job of identifying who that is that's committing those crimes and hold them accountable, you have a chance of giving your community a little bit of relief from that and doing that. Other crimes can be deterred and prevented. And we have a very fairly robust crime prevention unit here, a community engagement team is what we call it here at the Eugene Police Department. But some of that occurs when officers have discretionary time just to be in and around people's neighborhoods and stopping in at businesses, stopping in at neighborhood association meetings and connecting with people and finding out what's going on and talking to them. And when you have a police department that doesn't have the ability to do anything other than go from call to call to call, you really lose the opportunity of doing the community policing and building the relationships that you need to build in a community that I think is part of the cornerstone of 21st century policing with crime prevention and community policing is it takes time to build those relationships. And if all you have time to do is to just drive from one call to another, it really does a disservice not only to the relationship, but a disservice to the victims we're trying to serve.
You know, Ibrahim, coming to you, something that Chief Skinner said reminded me of a comment from Dr. Michael Hames-Garcia last week, which was that reality of the police sort of responding call to call to call, and thus they're not really out in the community developing relationships, often with the people who they're interacting with, whether it's victims or perpetrators of crime, except through that immediate response to a crisis situation. And so my question for you is, you know, as a member of the City of Eugene's Human Rights Commission, you have a unique insight into the experiences of marginalized individuals in our community. What do you think needs to be done to build or restore trust between this population and local law enforcement?
Okay, thank you for this question. And I have to say that I'm not speaking for the Eugene Human Rights Commission. I'm not the spokesperson. And at this point, I'm expressing myself as Ibrahim Kulibali. You know, interestingly, we had a conversation yesterday about the police response when it's come to even the protests we are having right now in Eugene. And it was brought to our attention that there was a kind of protest with some armed folks who were kind of expressing their hatred toward the Black Lives Matter movement. And the people on scene at this felt like Eugene police didn't show up until those people left. So they were by themselves, according to them, again, it has been reported to me, on the scene, and they tried to reach out to the police, Eugene police, and they haven't seen anybody around. So that's one of the things that the community will bring to our attention. And I'm part of a group called We See You, which is the whole community of Eugene United. And that group has members from pretty much all the communities, Pacific Islanders, Latino, Black, Gay, Jewish, Middle East, since we have somebody like Ib Amid, who is the owner of Soraya, part of the group. So the Human Rights Commission is unique in a way that they have work groups like We See You, but we also have public comment. So a lot of public comment comes from those community members. We come and ask or send us emails to ask the city to make recommendation to the city council, not from the police. And sometimes they come to express their own experience, their own encounter with the police, how traumatized they were after those things happened. So we've seen it often and often and often. To build trust between the police and between Eugene police and the community, it's gonna take time and it's gonna take more than what the stakeholders may be. It's not the leaders of Eugene police and the leaders of the community that would probably sit and build that trust. It has to be by interaction. It has to be proactive. The police officers themselves have to have that mindset about building trust, building rapport with the community, which is getting to know them first, getting to know people, spending time with them, and living in the community that you serve. That's very important. In France, the community safety officers are successful because they live in the community, they know people, they know what's going on. So that's one. The second thing is accountability. You know, people will trust the police if they know that if there is ever a misconduct, that misconduct would be looked at, it will be, they will get justice. But if there is no accountability, they cannot be trust. Because again, we have seen situation where the community is shocked of the outcome of a police misconduct investigation. So it has to be explained. And we also have to come together to find ways to keep people accountable. So unless we go there, unless we go that route, unless we try to talk about why police officers can get away with what is perceived by at least by the community as a misconduct, they cannot be trust. I think trust is based on, I know you are professional, you do your job, and I'll do your job. It doesn't matter if someone has a KKK tattooed on their back and they are in uniform, as long as they respect my right, as long as they respect me as a human being when they are in duty, I will respect them. So the trust is based on how professional you are doing your job. And if you make mistake, you have to fix it, or the department have to go all the way to the full length of investigation and get me justice. And that justice is the only way to build trust.
Thank you, Ibrahim. And David, I want to come to you. Ibrahim's really highlighted sort of the work that needs to be done from a kind of the professionalism of the Eugene Police Department and how they interact with the community. But as has been identified by Chief Skinner, the Oregon is one of the least police states, but also has these significant societal problems that contribute to kind of an increase in crime rate, at least here in Eugene. And so with that kind of tension in mind, my question to you, David, is what's the community's role in implementing alternative policing strategies like focused deterrence? What part should family members, church leaders, and social service providers play in delineating the line between telling people at high risk of violence to stop the violence and get help, or risk jail or prison if they continue to act out?
Well, that's a complex question, and I think I'm going to take the answer in a slightly different direction. Social intervention with individuals is hard, and it can't be reduced to an algorithm. It's a matter of people's social connection, how bonded they feel to others in their community, how supported they feel by others in their community, family, church, friends, coworkers. We can all help hold people responsible for good behavior. For example, we can call out racist talk when we hear it happening. We can intervene in the way that seems most likely to us to be helpful, to help people change their behavior, to let people know what kinds of behavior we find acceptable and what kinds of behavior we don't find acceptable. But that only has an effect if the person that we're addressing feels a connection to the community that input is coming from. And building those kinds of social connections is really fundamental to building a well-ordered society. And that's not a simple task. I don't have a formula for how to do it. But if we live our lives with the awareness that we want to create that kind of society, that's probably a good step in that direction.
Thank you, David. And thank you to our panelists. That concludes the Q&A portion of the program. And so we're going to turn now to the final segment, which are closing remarks. I'm going to allow each of you a couple minutes to kind of sum up your thoughts of the conversation and also relay to the community where your head's at as we move forward in this community discussion of reform in law enforcement. So I want to begin with you, Chief Skinner, kind of your closing remarks. Again, kind of summarizing where your head's at the end of this conversation, and really kind of what conversation do you want to have with the community going forward as we kind of continue this discussion of police reform in our community?
Yeah, we really look forward to having that discussion. And I was in a press conference yesterday with the mayor and Councilor Evans and made a comment that we'll look forward to a day where we can kind of more focus our attention on the outcomes that we're trying to achieve together as a community about what this police department is going to look like as we move into the future. I think of the police departments I've been a part of, this is my fourth agency I've been a part of, so I have a little bit of a unique perspective having been well-traveled, and would say that the types of people we're hiring now, the type of leadership we have, both at the local level, both electeds and within the city, uniquely positions us to do something special here in Eugene around police reform. And so we're ready to embrace that and looking forward to doing that. You know, having said that, I think we can also, as we recognize the mistakes that we make and recognize the work that needs to be done and recognize the trust that needs to be rebuilt, I think we can also recognize that the Eugene Police Department, and it's evidenced by your program last time, around police accountability, that the Eugene Police Department is probably ahead of most police departments when it comes to having systems in place around transparency and accountability. I mean, it's, you know, the fact that we've been in the body cam environment for almost 5 years now, while others are just now even getting in that space, is a testament to our ability to embrace change and want to be progressive. And one of the metaphors that I've often used is, you know, our starting weight is often other people's goal weight when it comes to that. And so that's a good place to be. It's a good place to start from. Having said that, we're not satisfied with where we're at. We recognize some vulnerabilities. We've recognized some blind spots through these last few months about the way we deal with protests, the way we deal with use of force, the way we report our use of force. And we're going to be making those adjustments. I'm going to leave this time with you all today, move straight into a 2-hour meeting with my senior staff on use of force reform and some things that we need to do differently there. And so if anything, during this really difficult time with the pandemic and with protests, and as heavy as it all feels, I feel like it's my job to leave people with a sense of hopefulness around a police department that wants to be a part of this community and wants to be more connected to this community, and especially our communities of color. And so we're trying to get ourselves well positioned to be able to have those conversations and invest in those relationships. And we'll look forward to doing that into the future.
Thank you, Chief. David, coming to you, you know, for your closing remarks, I want to make sure to highlight also, you know, a lot of the attention that Cahoots has been getting from really around the country for its model for an alternative to policing. And so in your closing remarks, perhaps even highlighting that history of what even brought Cahoots into being, and reflecting on that, what lessons from that experience do you think could be replicated now as our community considers new paths forward in redefining the scope of policing?
Okay. So Cahoots began by a really startling collaboration between Whitebird Clinic, which was a sort of radical alternative organization, and the Eugene Police Department. And with a lot of trepidation on both sides about entering into that relationship, we made it work. We made it work over a span of now over 31 years. And I think on both sides, we've learned from that relationship. And one thing I've learned is that the way to make progress on complex issues is by building relationships, even when relationships are hard to build, or especially when relationships are hard to build. And this conversation today is an example, a great example of this community's continuing work on building those relationships. And that is the way forward.
Thank you, David. And Ibrahim, to close out the conversation, I want to turn to you. And again, just want to highlight, you know, your really kind of comprehensive view of this issue, both being the president of the local chapter of the NAACP, but also serving on the Human Rights Commission. Where do you see the conversation needing to go from here forward?
Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank you for having this discussion and let David know that I was a White Bear volunteer once, and I like my time volunteering there. Moving forward, I think I want to go back to the motion, though, about if the community is contributing enough. I think, yes, we have to be clear that the amount of money, the taxes or whatever that people are putting, you know, toward those services, it means a lot to them. People are struggling, and but they're still paying taxes. And we have payroll tax coming, and a lot of people need the money, that money for themselves, but they're putting those money toward whatever the city decides that is priority. So for the funding from the community, that's what people can do. Now, do we need extra resources? Yes. Do we need to fund extra services? Yes, that's another discussion. So as a human rights commissioner, and I say again, I'm not speaking for the Human Rights Commission, and as a NAACP president, I have been involved in a lot of discussion, but I have also have personally been called. You know, sometime in the middle of the night, someone will call you to express their frustration. And most of the time, the person is crying, they have been victimized, and those kind of interactions do not make it to the news. And sometimes it's a poor customer service by the police officer. There is no really any law broken, but that interaction will traumatize the other person for a long time. So that kind of behavior, I don't know how you can address it, but it is what is driving a lot of distrust, or and anger from some people in the community. I know someone who has complained about being sexually harassed, even victimized by Eugene police officers. The investigation has been going on forever, according to her. And she ended up not trusting even people like me. She's like, yes, you're not doing anything to help. So that kind of trauma kind of blew away the trust, you know, at every level and within the community. So we have that going. We're glad that we have the conversation going with the Eugene Police Department. And we have accepted and taken any opportunity that we get to sit and talk with the police department. Just to express what we hear, that may not necessarily come in the form of complaint or in the form of lawsuit, you know, because we have a reporting system that people talk to us. And moving forward, I think we need to duplicate hearing sessions where people will come and express their frustration and try to give them those, you know, venues, well, those valves where they can express the anger and see how we can move forward as a community. So there is a lot to be done. We need probably more resources. Hopefully, the federal government and the counties are also doing bringing some money on the table, but at this point, I don't think we should be asking for the community to do more than they are already doing. I think that's going to be a big conversation. We should turn toward alternative sources of resources to be able to address the need of the community, and maybe what people are talking about redirecting some of the police fund, the resources going to the police to provide those social services.
Thank you, Ibrahim. And again, I want to thank our panelists for joining us for today's program. We have Ibrahim Koulibaly with the Eugene Springfield NAACP, David Zeiss of CAHOOTS, and Chief Chris Skinner of the Eugene Police Department. Thank you all. You have been listening to a City Club of Eugene program. I'm Josh Purvis. Thank you for joining us.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our Facebook page for more topics. We hope you are inspired to join us for our next podcast episode.